I'm John Kroll. Few diseases strike more fear than cancer. The word itself has become a metaphor for something creeping, unstoppable, and deadly. On No Limits today, we'll talk about the latest developments in treating this threat. We discuss advances in cancer cure and research. The conversation will include our guests, a panel of three oncologists, Dr. Robert Goulet of Community Health Network, Dr. Terry Vick of Riley Hospital for Children, and Dr. Eric Rubenstein of Franciscan St. Francis Hospitals. Please join the discussion by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, sending an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or shooting a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pool of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the latest in cancer care and research. We are pleased to have as our guests Dr. Robert Goulet of Community Health Network. Dr. Goulet, welcome to the program.
John, thank you very much.
It's good to have you here. Dr. Terry Vick of Riley at IU Health. Dr. Vick, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. And Dr. Eric Rubenstein of the Franciscan St. Francis Hospitals. Boy, they made that a tongue twister. Dr. Rubenstein, it's good to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
We also would invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I'd like to start a little bit with an overview question. Where are we now in the battle against cancer? I mean, not all that long ago, I'm a person of reasonable vintage. Cancer diagnosis was pretty much considered a death sentence. It's not quite that anymore. I'll start with Dr. Goulet on that one.
Well, certainly from the perspective of breast cancer,
which is your specialty.
Yes. And with regard to the mortality rate for breast cancer, since the mid-70s, the mortality rate has continued to drop in this country to the tune of around 22% now. So, and what that would suggest is that there is not only improvements in therapy, but also improvements in screening, mm-hmm. identifying patients who are at risk for the development of cancer.
So that means, obviously, we do a better job of catching it earlier.
Correct.
Okay. And then in terms of the therapy, what are the breakthroughs there that have made?
There are a variety of changes that have occurred. I think the major emphasis is moving toward the biological approach to the treatment of cancer. And there have been some landmark developments in the course of the past year that I think sort of portend where we're headed in the future. For example, converting a tumor that at one point may have been responsive to estrogen therapy, anti-estrogen therapy, mm-hmm. By providing treatment to that patient with a new agent that targets a new metabolic pathway, we can convert that tumor back to a tumor that's sensitive to anti-estrogen therapy. That is still in development, but the latest news from that trial would suggest that approach toward tumors that had become resistant to the standard therapies can be converted back. And again, I use that as an example of the more biological approach mm-hmm. to the disease.
Dr. Vick, I'd like to ask you the same sort of start-off question. Where are we in the battle against cancer?
Well, for childhood cancer, probably in the 60s, there wasn't much in the way of therapy except surgery and then just drugs that were developed in the 50s and 60s. We've literally learned how to use those drugs more and more effectively as the years go by, so that in the 60s, when the survival was maybe 10 or 20%, now when a child walks through the door with any kind of cancer, you're probably at the 75 to 80% cure rate overall, and certain types of cancers are 95+% chance of being cured.
And we'll get to that. I do want to talk about the differences, because so far we're talking about somewhat in a generic sense, but there are differences, and the mortality rates are vary depending upon the kind of cancer. Dr. Rubenstein, same question. Where do you think we are in the battle against cancer right now?
Well, I think we're making huge strides, but clearly there's a lot of differences between different types of cancers, and we're learning that even within a specific type of cancer, there are different diseases. So, for example, for breast cancer, we know that there are those that Dr. Goulet had alluded to that are sensitive to estrogen, and then there are those that are sensitive to other pathways, and some of them that are sort of more primitive, the so-called triple negative subtype, that we need to treat them differently. And I think if you look at current research for lung cancer, for example, we know that there are certain subtypes that have a different behavior, such as there is a specific protein called ALK, which is expressed in a subset of lung cancer patients, maybe 5%, that respond very nicely to a drug. But I think what we're getting more out of is this idea that there's a one-size-fits-all approach, and we're moving more into personalized therapy.
And how does that manifest? I mean, when you talk about moving into personalized therapy, could you break that down a little bit?
Well, I think there's several factors. I think one factor is, of course, the host, the patient who develops cancer. And some of the success in pediatric cancer has probably been because you're dealing with a younger, relatively healthier population. We had the cancer ball this year. One of the speakers was Emil Freirich, and I'm sure a pioneer. Mm-hmm. And I was just so fascinated to meet this man who, back in the 60s, was literally watching children bleed to death and was conducting clinical research on them. But now we see, years later, that, like I said, at 80 to 90% cure rate through a series of intensive therapies. Now, what we know is that an older mm-hmm. patient might not tolerate the same form of treatment. And myself, who conducts a lot of research in elderly patients with acute myeloid leukemia, there's a whole bunch of different challenges, and it's a different disease state in the sense that there are different biological factors that trigger the growth of that cancer, what makes it tick. And we have to understand what makes a cancer tick before we can, you know, put a monkey wrench in its plan
and figure out how to stop it. We are talking about cancer cure and research here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a couple of email questions from listeners. First one is, what resources are available to support cancer patient caregivers? I'll start. Dr. Goulet is looking pensive on that one. I'll start with you.
Well, actually,
presumably the answer is not enough, but
there certainly is an increased sensitivity to that issue, and I'm smiling because community sponsored a Men Against Breast Cancer symposium this past Saturday. With an emphasis on recognizing the issues that are involved and providing tools for caregivers to utilize in the care of the people they love. There are a number of organizations in the city. We're actually blessed by some extraordinary organizations, the Cancer Care Community, Little Red Door, the American Cancer Society, and there are a host of others that provide support resources with a focus on this. There are camps that have been established for the children of patients with cancer, for example, Camp Kesem. That's run out of Bloomington, where there's an effort to try and help the offspring of patients with cancer. So the resources are out there. They're not always evident. Another organization I failed to mention was the Young Survivors Coalition, which is a favorite of mine. And all of these organizations will be able to provide some direction with respect to this.
Dr. Rubenstein, what resources are available that perhaps Dr. Goulet hasn't mentioned?
Well, he mentioned a majority of the resources that I'm aware of. The Leukemia Lymphoma Society is also a good resource to patients who suffer from certain hematological cancers like leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma, and they can help provide with things like transportation. One of the biggest impacts in caring for someone with cancer that we don't pay enough attention to is just the devastating financial impact mm-hmm. that has on someone's life, not just, you know, lost wages from not being able to work, but the cost
of the care, cost of...
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and I would think, and I saved Dr. Vick for last on this because maybe because I'm a parent myself, I would think that it's a special set of circumstances when you have a child who is afflicted. What resources are in place to help parents and or siblings who are dealing with that?
Well, I think the comprehensive nature of cancer care is such that at Riley we have a dedicated group of social workers that know all of the resources that are available. It may be dependent on the patient's diagnosis. It may be dependent on their life circumstance, what's available to them. There's a whole host of ways to get support, both spiritual, social, financial as well, to deal with all of the issues that come up when you have to transport children back and forth to the hospital, get the other kids to school, keep the house running, keep somebody employed to keep the insurance. And I think all of those things are so complex nowadays that we literally have a group of social workers that help families maneuver through this system all the time. And it becomes a struggle. The stress of cancer in a family is such that, unfortunately, even under the best of circumstances, large numbers of families will break apart under that kind of stress.
That is unfortunate. We are talking about the advances in cancer care and research here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email to nolimits at WFYI.org, or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We have another email question that says, are sunblock products effective against the UV rays that cause skin cancer? Who would like to take that one first? I'm figuring I got three oncologists here. One of you ought to be able to answer that question. Dr. Vick.
Well, the standard answer would be to avoid the sun at all cost. long sleeves and hats. But I think the current sunblock products are fairly effective at both UVA and UVB. And I think, unfortunately, you really don't want to good tan every year. You want to avoid the sun. That's the best way to avoid the increased risk of skin cancer.
So suppose, though, you are a sun lover, and I'm speaking from some personal interest here. I love being outdoors, and I can't stand wearing long sleeve shirts when I'm exercising or anything like that. What's the best way to take care of yourself, Dr. Goulet?
This is a different union for me.
Okay, you don't have the cards in this one?
SPF 30 to 50, I suppose, 50. And the precautions that have already been mentioned.
Okay.
Yeah, I think reapplying sunscreen as well every 4 hours, avoiding tanning booths. yeah. I was very amazed that there was a study that came out last year about tanning booths causing melanoma. I thought it was very sort of a revelation. You know?
Yeah, sort of like... Cigarettes cause cancer or lung cancer.
Well, that's an interesting story. But
yeah. We are talking about cancer care and research here on No Limits. No Limits is part of our local programming at WFYI Radio, made possible by your support. If you've made a contribution during our spring pledge drive, we thank you. If not, please consider supporting WFYI and our local news and programming. You can call in your pledge at 1-800-233-0020. or make a donation online at WFYI.org. We're talking again about cancer care and research here on No Limits. Our guests are Dr. Robert Goulet, Dr. Terry Vick, and Dr. Eric Rubenstein. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, as well as your host. We are talking today about the latest in cancer care and research. My guests, all of them oncologists, are Dr. Robert Goulet, who is with Community Health Network, Dr. Terry Vick, who is with Riley at IU Health, and Dr. Eric Rubenstein, who is with Franciscan St. Francis Hospitals. And I should say, because I know we're going to get a question on this at some point, a moment of levity, since cancer can be a fairly serious subject. Dr. Goulet, we talked about this offline. You are no relation to the singer, as far as we know.
No.
No? Okay.
No. But I can certainly belt out.
Well, and that might be.
You can harmonize.
Yeah. Oh, great. The singing oncologist. This is a moment in radio. Well, what I'd like to talk about now, really, is the kinds of cancers that we have made the greatest gains in, and then correspondingly the ones that have been most resistant to treatment or to advances in terms of dealing with it. And I'll start with Dr. Rubenstein on that. Which ones have we made the greatest gains in?
Well, I think I like to break up cancers into sort of the solid and the liquid tumors, and the solid tumors being those that are solid that you can see and palpate, and then of course the liquid tumors that tend to be in the bone marrow, such as leukemias, lymphomas, myelomas. I think with solid tumors, the greatest advances, as Dr. Goulet had alluded to, is screening.
Mm-hmm.
Things that you can see. So for breast cancer, women going for mammography, high-risk patients perhaps going for MRIs of the breast to, mm-hmm. to determine lesions, an earlier curable stage. Colonoscopy, hugely important for patients with any kind of family history of colon or endometrial cancer, because about 50% of patients over the age of 50 don't go for their colonoscopy, and that could have huge economic impact as well as cure impact. As far as solid tumors, where we're lagging behind are the tumors that are just that deeper and difficult to detect, such as pancreatic cancer. That's sort of the real cockroach of solid tumors.
Yeah, we lost a family member to pancreatic cancer, and I gather that's part of the reason I asked the question. Is I gather a large part of the challenge here is whether you can detect it early enough, and in pancreatic cancer, by the point you can detect it, it's generally so far advanced that it's difficult to treat. Is mm-hmm. that accurate?
Very, very accurate. As far as with liquid tumors, I think the advent of bone marrow transplantation is curing a higher percent of younger, healthier patients in the adult population. And, of course, some of the – I'll let Dr. Vick talk more about the pediatric hematology breakthroughs. One of the biggest breakthroughs, I think, that's sort of the – I guess poster child for drug development, of course, is CML,
which is
a chronic myelogenous leukemia. And it'll go back to my point that I stated earlier about understanding what makes the cancer tick. So in that disease, you have a specific translocation between two chromosomes. It would be the 9th and the 22nd chromosome, and it's called the Philadelphia chromosome. And what occurs there is you develop this fusion protein.
I got to stop and ask, why the Philadelphia chromosome? How did it get that name? Someone didn't like Philadelphia, or?
I think it was a Jets fan, actually. A Giants fan, I'm sorry.
Giants fan.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was just, I think that I like benign hematologists a lot more than I like malignant hematologists because they name things after what they are, and so you can remember them. As you can understand with our sort of expanding knowledge base, the amount of things that we're responsible for as physicians, it's terrible when people name things after cities mm-hmm. or themselves. I mean, I hope there's never, ever a Rubenstein syndrome. There may be one that
like
I suffer
that.
From,
yeah.
But it's not been...
But it's not been established as, yeah. as a name yet.
So back to that, there's this fusion protein that is what we call a tyrosine kinase. And that is... enzyme that helps trigger growth and production of various substances for cells to divide and proliferate. And so we know that they have this specific fusion, and it's sort of like a hybrid version of one gene and another gene merged together, making this protein product. And you can have a medication called imatinib directly binding to that protein, and you go from a disease that was invariably fatal within 3 to 5 years to a disease where you have patients who are around 20 years later just taking one pill a day. And it's pretty amazing because the side effect profile is much different than what you would expect with chemotherapy. You don't lose your hair. You're not in a hospital bed.
Yeah. Dr. Vick, I wanted to ask you, pick up on Dr. Rubenstein's point about breakthroughs in terms of dealing with children who have cancer. Where have the greatest breakthroughs occurred, and what areas are still the biggest threats?
So the biggest breakthroughs probably have been in the area of acute lymphoblastic leukemia, the common childhood leukemia. Mm-hmm. In that disease, we've found that giving more intensive treatments make the cure rate go from 50% up to 90%, and just by changing and adding drugs that we've had for 30 or 40 years, just figuring out better ways to use those available drugs. On a similar note, though, one of the biggest advances in the last 10 years with ALL is identifying that some children with ALL also have this Philadelphia chromosome that we've just been talking about. And with that disease, before the use of imatinib, you had about a 20% chance of being cured. But adding that one drug to the standard chemotherapy regimen, we've boosted cure rates for children with Philadelphia positive ALL up to 80%. And that's just been in the last 10 years that kind of breakthrough has been made. So it's finding those molecular targets, finding those markers of disease that allow us to then use drugs that are being developed or may be developed in the future to better target the treatment for those rare but deadly diseases.
We are talking about cancer care and research here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Katie who says, how can doctors motivate patients to become more active in clinical research? Dr. Goulet, I'll throw that one your way.
And that is an area that actually the National Cancer Institute has a division to try and augment participation in trials. It turns out that Katie's question is a very good question, because only about 5% of patients that are treated for cancer are treated in the context of a clinical trial.
Why is that?
I think part of it has to do with awareness and availability of the research trials to patients. I think there is a fear of participating in a trial that might be a negative trial and a reliance on the traditional ways of treating certain diseases. And there are segments of our population, the African-American segment in our population specifically, that have been disserved by the research community historically in our country. And so there's a suspicion about participating in trials and the fear of becoming a guinea pig. So with those preconceptions, and again, the lack of promotion of the trials or accessibility to the trials, I think patients don't participate.
How do you structure that conversation? I mean, what if you're talking with a patient about taking part in clinical research? You know, how do you frame it? I mean, how do you start that, Dr. Goulet?
Well, I think it's important to initiate the thought process related to that right from the outset of the discussion of what the treatment, what the standard treatment is going to look like, and incorporate the possibilities of participating in a trial. It also has to do a lot with the phase of the patient's disease. Patients that are being treated for advanced disease, metastatic disease, the discussion is very different than it would be with a patient with a stage 1 breast cancer, for example, or a stage 0 breast cancer. But again, I think the discussion has to happen early in the process. It can't. It's not something you add on. You need to be conscious of it. And interestingly,
right at the point of diagnosis, or do you start at the conversation then, or a little later?
When we start talking about initial therapy, we try and alert the patient to what's available for them. And I think the point I was starting to make was what's interesting to me is how historically research has been reserved for institutions like Riley and IU, and the greater emphasis that community healthcare systems are. Community small C, or like Eric's program, and how there are organizations that can facilitate research at a national level through smaller hospital networks. And so I think there's a national effort to try and improve that accrual to research trials.
And I want to talk more in a bit about the where the next wave really of breakthroughs is going to be. But I wanted to come back and pick up on a point that Dr. Vick was making, or actually something it spurred with me. If I'm sensing a motif in this discussion, it is that early detection is absolutely essential. And that many of the gains are a product of the fact that we're just finding this stuff earlier. I would think that gets a little bit more difficult when you're dealing with children, in part because, you know, as we say, most people, whether they follow on it, through on it or not, are aware they're supposed to get a colonoscopy, when they hit 50 and all of that. When you think of a child, you don't necessarily think life-threatening illness, that's not your first. Are there certain warning signs or things that people should be paying attention to, and what could parents do to make sure that their children get the best possible chance if they are afflicted with cancer?
I think the nice thing about children is that they routinely have built-in doctor visits as they're growing and developing, so they've got to be seen multiple times in the first 5 and 10 years of their life. So they're getting their immunizations and their checkups, but they're checking for growth and development. And a good history, a good physical exam by a pediatrician or a family physician, a few simple screening things like an occasional check for anemia, and paying attention to symptoms like chronic pain or easy bruising or unusual symptoms like that. That's all you really need in pediatrics. I think the cancers tend to be very aggressive in children, so finding it a month early or 2 months early rarely will make a difference in what you do for treatment. And so just paying attention to how your child is and whether they have new symptoms that are developing, that's really all you need to do in children.
What should your first step be? If you're a parent or whatever, you notice one of these symptoms, say easy bruising or something like that, or bruises appearing for no apparent reason, call your pediatrician immediately, or where should you go with that, Dr. Vick?
I think it's best to have a pediatrician, family physician that's followed your child longitudinally. Most of these things are not emergency room kind of visits, but they're urgent visits, meaning the next day or so to be seen by the physician, who can then order an appropriate test to to allay your fears
or allow you to deal with it, yes. if it comes about. In terms of the ongoing challenges of this, we've talked about pancreatic cancer, are there other cancers that have been particularly resistant to treatment and it sounds like the silver bullet here is detection, other than pancreatic cancer? And I'll start with Dr. Rubenstein.
Well, of course, there's many cancers that we have failed to deliver on. It's not limited to detection. Mm-hmm. Even with some of the blood cancers. Mm-hmm.
Even if you detect it, you can't treat it, really.
Correct. Yeah. And so I think I kind of want to go back to one point about the importance, sure, of clinical trials, and that clinical trials are not just about trying drugs and testing drugs on humans. They're also about behavior modifications that also may have a huge impact, and screening tests. So, for example, it's been demonstrated in colon and breast cancer that by eating a low-fat diet and exercising regularly, in some cases you can reduce your recurrence rate by up to 50%. But there are other challenges. Go ahead.
No, I'm just making a signal real quickly. Go ahead, your point, please.
So, glioblastomas are a challenge that we've failed to make a – lung cancer is a huge problem because of the other factors associated with lung cancer. That's a very complicated cancer because it's never just one thing with lung cancer. There's usually a series of mutations in lung cancer. So I think it's hard to summarize, give you a good answer for that. It's too big of a list. I would say it's easier to talk about the cancers where we have made significant
progress rather than, well, although it's the ones that are still on the list. Obviously, if you've got a 90-95% treatment or survival rate, that's no longer probably a tremendous priority in terms of research. It's the ones that have been resistant so far, presumably. It's not just about detection. What are the other things that resist treatment? I mean, what are the other factors involved there? Is it that we just don't know how the cancer operates? What makes it tick?
Well, it's the other things that we do to ourselves. Eating the wrong types of diets. Mm-hmm. If you look at other parts of the world, you'll see a different landscape as far as cancers that are seen. As well as smoking cigarettes, mm-hmm, drinking excessive alcohol. I believe that cancer is never just one thing. I think that's sort of the take-home message, because a frequent question you get asked when you see a patient who's recently been diagnosed with cancer is, why me? Mm-hmm. Was it this pill that I was taking? Was it because I worked in this plant? Mm-hmm. Was it genetic? Again, it's never just one thing, and that's why a lot more research needs to be done to help categorize different cancer presentations, even within that disease state.
We are talking about cancer care and research here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. No Limits is part of our local programming at WFYI Radio, made possible by your support. If you've made a contribution during our spring pledge drive, we thank you. If not, please consider supporting WFYI and our local news and programming. You can call in your pledge at 1-800-233-0020 or make a donation online at WFYI.org. We're talking again about cancer care and research here on No Limits with our guests, Dr. Robert Goulet, Dr. Terry Vick, Dr. Eric Rubenstein. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the latest in cancer care and research. We have as our guest Dr. Robert Goulet, who's with Community Health Network, Dr. Terry Vick at IU, or Riley at IU Health, and Dr. Eric Rubenstein of Franciscan St. Francis Hospitals. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. 3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to talk real quickly about the clinical research question. And I know, Dr. Rubenstein, that St. Francis is one of the three local hospital networks taking part in the National Genome Atlas Project. Could you talk a little bit about what that is and why it's important? And I'd like, frankly, all three of you to talk about why the clinical research is so important at this stage. Dr. Rubenstein.
Well, I think this is a very important project. One of the advances in science and genetics was that we were able to sequence the entire human genome.
Mm-hmm.
And the genome consists of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
But what's fascinating about DNA is that not all DNA that we have has an apparent purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It's broken up into different segments. So some of the segments are called exons, which have the genetic material
mm-hmm.
that we express. And then there's this area in between that's called introns, and we're mm-hmm. not sure what to make of that. But now there are some efforts for some of the more common cancers, and we participate at St. Francis, I believe, at Community as well. They participate in this
mm-hmm.
looking at cancer tissue and sequencing the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
of the cancer, so that instead of looking at five or six samples, now we have thousands of samples from multiple centers across the country, and we will thereby be establishing this library of DNA mm-hmm. sequencing. And this library is going to be available for researchers to analyze that in the context of different cancers from a prognostic standpoint, eventually from a therapeutic standpoint, so that we could see, based on these genetic sequences, if we can make these predictions. And I think it's very important for investigators that we have more of this collaborative spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of a movie that was, I think it was a Wes Anderson movie, where Bill Murray plays this neurologist. I think the movie is called The Royal Tannenbaums.
Oh, okay.
And this neurologist walks around with this notepad.
Yeah.
And he documents the story of this boy named Dudley. And Dudley was sort of this odd child and creates all these different syndromes based on this one boy. And I feel that there's too much segregation amongst different hospital groups and different doctors. Where they do things a certain way because that's what they're used to or that's what is the standard. I think it's important to have more of these collaborative efforts where now we have the numbers and you need the numbers to establish statistical significance. And statistical significance is usually what will prove that one factor is associated with this prognosis or this factor is associated with this outcome or this treatment will help this group of patients. And that is how we can sort of sort out which patients will eventually benefit from newer treatments and be cured. But it all starts, this is a baby step. And this is sort of a very important effort to establish this library that will be there for all physician investigators.
Dr. Goulet, obviously in breast cancer, you've shown some tremendous gains. How important is the research going forward?
Well, to distill Eric's comments, I'm certainly much more simplistic in my approach. If the veins and the arteries weren't different colors, I don't think I could do the surgery. So I'm looking for targets. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, as Eric alluded to with his description of the genome, what we need are unique elements in the genetic makeup of a tumor, and that serves as a target. We have some very excellent examples of biological therapy, one of them being Herceptin
mm-hmm.
or bevacizumab or trastuzumab,
mm-hmm.
trastuzumab, where this agent is an antibody directed at a very specific target on the tumor. We have a group of tumors called triple negative breast cancers which are extremely difficult tumors to treat. And in fact, they affect African-American women five times greater than the Caucasian population. There are no targets for this tumor. And so the challenge is to identify the target to develop therapeutic agents against those tumors. And so when I look at the genome, it is a very specific piece of information that I would like to get for my patients, and that is, what is it about the tumor that's unique? What is it about the tumor that's vulnerable that will allow us to develop agents against it? And the holy grail in cancer is looking for that common denominator, that one metabolic malfunction. And I think Eric alluded to it earlier, that you're not looking at a homogeneous disease here. You're looking at probably several diseases simultaneously. So that's where my excitement comes in. And there are applications for this now in cancer care. By doing a genetic analysis of a breast cancer, you can determine who will benefit and who won't benefit from the addition of chemotherapy. These are, again, these are early applications, but extraordinarily exciting.
We are talking about cancer care and research here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. Your question or comment, please.
It's just a comment. I'm a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma survivor. I was diagnosed in October of 2004 and was in remission until February of last year, but I didn't get treated at any of the hospitals represented. Nonetheless, I just wanted to thank the doctors for all their hard work and just to testify that being in Indianapolis is a great place to be in if you're going to get diagnosed. It's been a wonderful experience, if that makes any sense. It's just been doctors have been fantastic, and the tools available in Indianapolis just been wonderful. So I just wanted to say thanks.
Thank you very much for the call, Ryan, and best of luck to you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, and I imagine that's got to be one of the more gratifying parts of your job. We've talked about some heavy, relatively dry. That's a very human element here, that we talk about the cancer, and we've talked to some degree almost in abstract terms here. It affects human beings. It affects their lives. When you have a success story like Ryan's, seems to have been, and feel that gratified by it. Terry Vick, could you talk a little bit, Dr. Terry Vick, about what it's like when you are able to win one?
Well, I think the caller displayed some of the emotion that we get to feel fairly frequently in childhood cancer. So I'm also the director of the Childhood Cancer Survivor Program at Riley. So over the last 20 years, we've had roughly probably about 1,300 survivors of childhood cancer. So I see kids who were diagnosed as young children, preschoolers, school-age kids now graduating from high school, going on to have families of their own. So it's actually very gratifying to see what kids can develop into after even having such a bad diagnosis at an early age.
We have actually a Facebook comment from one of your fans, Dr. Vick. This is from a listener named Jenny, who says, many thanks to Dr. Terry Vick, who was our daughter's primary oncologist when she was diagnosed with ALL in 2004. She just hit the 5-year treatment mark, which is huge. We owe Mickey's life to Dr. Vick and other amazing staff at Riley. Obviously, I let Dr. Vick, if you would like to say a few words to Jenny and Mickey, apparently, I'll offer that and then take it around so that each of you can share a success story.
Well, I think that's what's gratifying. That's why we do the job we do, because you know that there are kids that you can treat and cure, and even the ones that you can't cure, I think the families that you know, the children, young adults that you know, you can add to their lives. They can contribute to your life and your experience. They're what drive us to go to work every day and try to figure out ways to treat and diagnose and come up with new ideas for curing kids with cancer. And, you know, that's kind of why we go to work every day.
Dr. Rubenstein, success story. How gratifying is that?
Well, first off, I'd like to, you know, thank Ryan for calling in and sharing that story. I think there's lots of success stories, and success is measured in many different ways. I think it's very important if someone's diagnosed with cancer, the first thing to ask their oncologist is, and no one, everyone wants to be cured, is that what are the expectations and what is the goal of the treatment? So for a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, you can cure that about 60 or 70% of the time. But that's not good enough. And that's it's not good enough until it's 100%. And so that's why I think it's important when I talk to a patient on day one with a diagnosis that your options basically include getting the standard of care or participating in a clinical trial. And because of clinical trials, Ryan is making that phone call. I would imagine he received a combination treatment, probably something R-CHOP, if he had a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. I don't know what he had because I'm not talking to him. But that was only established because of clinical trials. The drug that has been combined with standard CHOP chemotherapy is a drug called Rituxan. And that drug targets a specific molecule on a lymphocyte, which are the cancer cells, and targets that for the immune system to take care of it. And so one of the gratifying experiences I had was taking care of an elderly gentleman who was in his 70s, who benefited from a new drug that has recently been approved. It's called Adcetris, and it targets an anti-CD30 molecule. And he entered a complete remission after receiving this antibody that had some poison attached to it, and has been in remission for a year now. And it's very gratifying to get someone from a state of relapsed disease and almost certain death with very minimal toxicity, getting them to a point where they're, again, in complete remission and enjoying their days and making the most of what time they have.
Dr. Goulet, I'm going to give you the last word on this and a relatively quick one. Because we've got some good questions here that I want to get to.
Very quick. My answer is that I get much more than I give. And to Terry's point, I you get something from everybody. And success always isn't measured in whether or not you can make a tumor disappear. It's helping people live with their cancer. And
deal with a particularly difficult time.
Yeah.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Stephanie. Email question says, the president's cancer panel made a recommendation to begin to study the thousands of poorly understood chemicals that are in common use in our everyday lives. Can your guest talk or comment on any research locally into this issue or other cancer prevention efforts? I'll stay with you, Dr. Goulet.
This is probably one of the most frustrating, difficult areas to conduct research in, and breast cancer is replete with studies. The cranberry bog studies from the Long Island breast cancer studies are a perfect example of exposures to DDT and the impact that that had on women's risk for developing cancer. The women that were in that locale had about a fivefold greater increase of breast cancer over the general population. And although you can demonstrate increased levels of DDT in the women's fat, you can't demonstrate that the DDT directly caused their breast cancer. It's timing. It's, you know, when was a patient exposed to the carcinogen? And it can be any time in their lifetime. It's the concentration of the exposure. It's what happened in follow-up after the exposure to the carcinogen. So again, this sounds terrific, The effort sounds terrific, but it's replete with frustration.
And I'll take it around the horn real quickly. We've got just a very little time left to ask, where in like a five-word burst, where are the next great opportunities for advances? I'll start with you, Dr. Vick.
I think the advances are in the areas of bioinformatics, proteomics, and genomics, understanding what may be causing genetic damage, and therefore, how can you target it to fix it?
Dr. Rubenstein, we've got about 30 seconds left. Real quickly, what are the next great opportunities for advances?
That's a very difficult question to answer in 30 seconds, but I will say the great opportunity is to work together as a community and to prioritize clinical research.
Dr. Goulet, the next great opportunity for an advance.
Both of my colleagues have said it all. It's genetics and taking it from bench to bedside.
We have been talking today about cancer care and research and have been fortunate to have as our guest Dr. Robert Goulet of Community Health Network. Dr. Goulet, thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Jim.
And thank you for sharing your stories. Dr. Vick of Riley at IU Health. Dr. Vick, thank you. Obviously,
thanks.
Your fans are listening, so it was good to have you on the program. And Dr. Eric Rubenstein of Franciscan St. Francis Hospitals, thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
Greatly appreciate it. I'd like to thank all of my listeners, and particularly those who called in or shared their stories, sent questions in. We will be back next week when we will be talking about the importance of early childhood reading and learning. We will see you next week. Thank you for spending this time with us. I am John Krall. Take care.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.